This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Let's start today with our week in review and that long and uncertain road toward casino gambling in the Commonwealth. The latest news, a WBUR poll shows slumping support for casino gambling across the state. And Boston Mayor Marty Walsh insists residents of Boston should have a say about whether a casino can be built on their city's border.
I'm not looking to kill anything. I'm looking for the community, or the neighbors of the people in those communities to decide on what they want.
Also this week, Boston physician Vivek Murthy in the crosshairs of the National Rifle Association, trying to block his appointment to be the next attorney general.
He's hell-bent on treating a constitutional freedom like a disease. That should offend and concern everybody, whether you're a Second Amendment supporter or not.
And Northeastern University suspends a pro-Palestinian rights group for passing out flyers, raising concerns about free speech rights on the Boston campus.
The content of our message cannot be ignored because the policies are only being selectively enforced against us.
We'll dive into those stories and more in just a moment. But first, some news this afternoon that the FBI and a Florida prosecutor have cleared the agent who shot and killed a Chechen man linked to the Boston Marathon bombing suspects. According to reports, officials say the agent was justified in using deadly force during an interrogation of Ibrahim Todashev last year in Florida. Joining us now with more on this story is WBUR's David Boeri. Hi, David.
Hi, Anthony.
Remind us first why FBI agents and Massachusetts State Police officers were in Florida last year interrogating Ibrahim Todashev.
They were there because they'd found out he was a friend of Tamerlan and Zanayev. And within a couple of days of the bombing, they were there. They found his phone, a phone call that he had made with Zanayev. They were there just in short order. And then after about a month, they suddenly turned to the subject of that triple homicide in Waltham. They wanted to know what his involvement was, if any, and what Zanayev's involvement was.
All right. And as we know, something went terribly wrong during that interrogation. It resulted in Todashev being shot and killed. So what are we hearing today?
All we're hearing today is that the so-called independent investigation that was being done by a Florida state attorney, the report of which was due on Tuesday, is going to clear the FBI agent who shot Todashev of any wrongdoing. He's going to determine, according to the reports, that it was a justified shooting. That is followed now by some stories, some other leaked stories that indicate that the FBI and the Department of Justice, whose reports have not yet been released, will also clear the agent of any kind of suspicion of a wrongful shooting. So that all comes up. And if you believe it, that 10 months after the FBI started this investigation and without coming to any kind of report, suddenly it and the DOJ have completed their reports and they're due, coincidentally, a day or two after the Florida report is released.
Mm. So, David, obviously, this was a hugely troubling story. It raised a lot of questions about, among other things, law enforcement procedures. What questions remain unanswered?
All the questions remain unanswered because we haven't seen the report. We've seen none of the reports. And the most, what happened in Orlando, the biggest question, perhaps, is how in the world the FBI and several state troopers from Massachusetts conducted a five-hour interview in the home of a suspect with a hair-trigger temper, a history of assault of behavior, and some suspicious actions, why they interviewed him in his own home, where, by the way, he knew where the weapons were, if there were any, thereby endangering themselves and clearly him. So he is shot to death. The determination is going to be made whether they were justified in shooting him. However, the rest of that story is, how did they contribute to making that a dangerous situation in the first place, rather than to have brought him into a safe facility to interrogate him?
Big questions indeed. WBUR's David Boeri, thanks so much for bringing us up to date. We
You're
appreciate
welcome.
It. So let's introduce our Week in Review panel. Joan Vinocchi, columnist for the Boston Globe, is here in the studio to dig through these topics with us today. Hi, Joan. Good to have you in.
It's nice to be here in the studio.
Yeah, it's nice to have you in the studio. And sitting right beside you, Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute as well. Hello, Jim.
It's good to be with you.
So first of all, your reaction to this late-breaking news about the killing of Ibrahim Todashev. Joan, you heard David sort of debrief there. What do you make of what we know now?
Well, I would say if the report is accurate that the FBI agent has been cleared, the tradition continues, because the New York Times reported in a fairly lengthy story last June that between 1993 and 2011, the FBI was involved in 80 fatal shootings and 70 in which people were wounded, and in every single case, the agent was cleared of any wrongdoing.
Oh, boy.
So there's no surprise here, but it is, you know, there are still many questions, as David pointed out, and the biggest one is, why did it take them so long?
Yeah. Jim?
Look, I would wait for the full story to make any real comments, but I think what Dave was just reporting in terms of the coincidental release of the various reports underscores the fact that we all, I think, were pretty uncomfortable with what we learned about that. The changing story, originally I think they said Todorov had lunged at them with a knife and they retracted on that. When there's that level of movement on a story, changing story, I think we all become very skeptical. I personally am just always very skeptical about the use of force by governmental forces, simply because there is really no good check on whether they do it in a way that is justified or not.
Mm. Well, really troubling story. Obviously, more information to come. It'll be interesting when that final report is finally out, because right now, to this point, we're just getting reports about the report. More information next week is expected. So let's shift gears and talk to news closer to home and talk about casino gambling and the sort of bumpy road that the Commonwealth is pursuing toward casino gambling. This week, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh made a dramatic appearance before the Gambling Commission and insisted that Boston should be treated like a host community, even if the proposed casinos will be sited in Everett or East Boston.
The importance of this issue to the residents of the city of Boston brings me here today. The potential impact of casinos goes to the core of the quality of life of our neighborhoods.
So if Boston is a host, is given host status, it would give the city a vote on proposed casinos and basically a veto. Commission Chair Stephen Crosby said that Boston's plea for host status comes very late.
Don't be disingenuous about this. This process has been going on for a long time. This specific issue has been addressed at least twice. The host community issue was started last summer and has been resolved.
So, Joan, let me ask you first, what's the mayor up to here? Is he looking does he want a chance to veto a casino?
You got me. This one confuses me. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought East Boston voted not to be a host community. So yeah. if they voted not to be a host community, now Boston wants to be a host community. I think it's confusing. I mean, I think Marty Walsh appears to be bargaining, negotiating for more money from a casino if it's ultimately cited there. But I find it hard. I guess there's some legal argument that he will present at the hearing that they said that he can now have, in which they'll make the case that because everything but the casino, the hotel and other things, are sited in Boston, that even though East Boston said it didn't want to be a host community, somehow it now is.
It is confusing. Jim, help sort this out. So the commission agreed to consider Boston's contention, even though we heard Stephen Crosby saying this has already been resolved, blah, 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 at least twice. The commission did agree to consider Boston's contention for host status and decide that within 2 weeks. What do you see playing out here?
I agree with what Joan said in terms of trying to get negotiating power here. You mentioned bumpy road and slumping support. Look, if they don't give Boston some greater voice in this, it's going to be really hard for them to move this project forward. There was a change in leadership, by the way, in Boston in the middle of this entire process. And I think that what Marty Walsh is trying to say is, look, the transportation infrastructure, all the rest is all Boston. We are the core attraction. What he'd like to do is not block the project, but I think what he wants is higher compensation, and he wants to understand what kind of mitigation the city would get. He has to do this politically, and I would say that for Stephen Crosby and for the governor to put Boston into the spot where they don't have the ability to negotiate for higher compensation, have a voice in this, that's a political loser.
Yeah, interesting. Well, Jim, you mentioned slumping support. In fact, I mentioned it. A new poll out from WBUR this week showed that people in the state have soured quite a bit on legalized gambling. The poll found that 46% support casinos, 43% do not. That's within the margin of error for the poll, and a big change from November when polls found roughly 60-30 in favor of casinos. So Joan, I mean, this becomes important if it ends up on the ballot to ban casino gambling.
Yes, that ballot question now becomes the big shoe to drop or not drop, depending on what the SJC decides.
Yeah.
And with the public seeing this whole process play out and seeing all the gamesmanship and all the stuff going on. It's a real question. If it is on the ballot, it may get voted down, and then what are we going to do?
And then
not have casinos.
Interesting.
Good ending.
Yeah. I mean, Jim, we had someone on our air this week making the point that even if the Commonwealth is sort of split, the anti-casino energy is so much stronger when it comes to, you know, getting folks out on an election day on a ballot initiative that this really could be trouble for casino gambling going forward.
I completely agree with that. Look, when we first started thinking about casinos, it was a shiny bauble on a mantelpiece. But then people started putting their fingerprints on it, and there was dust that accumulated. When people look at it close up, NIMBY is a big issue. A lot of people start saying, well, what does it mean for traffic? What does it mean for this? It becomes a much more real issue for them. Anti-anything usually keeps the kind of political cohesion in a stronger way than if you're for something. So that doesn't surprise me.
Yeah.
But in this case, I think it's going to build even more strongly.
Yeah.
I was just going to add that you mentioned the change in leadership. Well, we have a new mayor who might not have quite the same passion for it as Mayor Menino had. And Governor Patrick is in his last year, and he was really the force at one point behind the casino push. I don't think any of the candidates for governor are quite that passionate about it. So the ground really has shifted beneath this.
The one thing I would say is don't bet against the casinos.
Yeah.
They've got a lot of money.
No, right. Too soon to do that. And as you say, it would be a tough bet, especially against that industry. So let's switch gears and talk about Boston physician Vivek Murthy, who President Obama has nominated to be the next Surgeon General of the United States. Last month, he appeared before the Senate and said his pro-gun control views would not affect his actions as America's top doc. Here he is.
I do not intend to use the Surgeon General's office as a bully pulpit for gun control. That is not going to be my priority. As we spoke about, my priority and focus is going to be on obesity prevention. There are a number of public health challenges that are facing our nation. My concerns with regard to issues like gun violence have to do with my experience as a physician.
So that was last month. Now, suddenly the National Rifle Association has decided to mobilize their considerable congressional firepower to block the nominee. Here's NRA lobbyist Chris Cox on Fox News this week.
Mr. Murthy's not just a gun control supporter. He's a gun control activist. And it's clear that his agenda is to treat a constitutional freedom like a disease. That's not something the National Rifle Association's going to sit idly by and watch happen. We're going to engage 5 million members and tens of millions of supporters and make sure they know the truth and the United States Senate knows the truth.
So, Joan, your paper, The Globe, has called for the president to stand up for this nominee. They wrote, if Murthy withdraws, the NRA will have bullied its way across a new line. What do you think is going to happen here?
Well, what's interesting is that the NRA has power. So much so that 10 Democrats in the Senate have said that they are inclined to vote no against Dr. Murthy. And I think that's the outrageous part. It's one thing for the NRA to bully and flex its muscles, but if Democrats who supposedly believe in some sort of gun control run scared like this, well, they hand them a victory. So I fault the Democrats for political cowardice as much as the NRA for political bullying.
It seems when it comes to the NRA, it seems like they're sort of flexing their muscle, Jim, in new ways. I mean, we think of the group as confining itself to gun-related legislation in the past, but this seems like new territory for them.
Well, I think it's all about the Senate elections. The control of the Senate's in play. I think the NRA wants to send a signal in support of Republicans, and they see this as a play to do it. What's actually, I think, very interesting to me is the fact that we've had a few difficult nominations in the past, say, 5 months, and there are splits among the Democrats because of their fear of losing the Senate. What I would say also is that, Murthy was going to focus on a pretty important issue for the country, which is obesity, and hopefully from from the perspective of expertise and thinking about that, that's something we're going to lose. But this is truly all about the Senate, the control of the Senate.
Yeah, well, Joan.
Two quick points. What's losing the Senate? What's the point of having the Senate if the Democrats in the Senate don't vote for a nominee presented by the president who is a Democrat? And in terms of the NRA rhetoric, I mean, it's such hyperbole. What Murthy said in a tweet is that guns are a health care issue. And you know what? If a gun is loaded and fired at somebody, it is a health care issue.
Yeah, hard to argue with that point. Well, let's move on to another constitutional issue, or maybe not a constitutional issue, depending on your point of view on this one. The Northeastern chapter of Students for Justice in Palestine was suspended from campus, from Northeastern campus, for what the university says were a series of violations of its bylaws, including unauthorized leafleting. The university won't talk publicly about this. It wouldn't come on our air, but civil libertarians are up in arms. Boston civil rights attorney Harvey Silverglate was on our show yesterday and said the school's position was indefensible. He said the bigger issue was outside pressure over a controversial issue, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Here's what he said.
Northeastern is squelching them, not because it doesn't like the message. I don't think administrations like or dislike messages, but because they're suffering criticism from donors, alumni, and other groups.
So, Jim, let me ask you, start off with you on this. This isn't the first time, of course, that this issue has flared up on a college campus in this city or indeed across this country. What's your take on this issue?
I have four very quick takes. One is Harvey Silverglate overall is my hero. I mean, on this issue, I'm just a great supporter of free speech on campuses, which should be really these bastions of free speech and debate, even difficult debate. So I agree completely. If this is just about the flyers, they are pretty innocuous. In the sense the flyers themselves said, well, this is a pretend eviction notice. Hey, this is not a true eviction notice. So that really is not that big of an issue. The third point I make is this. Dr. Aoun is a Lebanese-born.
The president of Northeastern.
And this is a very difficult issue for him. I say this as I'm half Syrian, and, you know, when you talk about Arab things as an Arab, it can be very, very complex. I'd say the last thing is this. I wouldn't make a hero out of Max Geller, who's the head of the student group. He has appeared in photographs with pictures emblazoned on his T-shirt of Nasrallah, who is the head of Hezbollah, a radical group. He's also worn keffiyeh with emblazoned the insignia of one of the most radical Islamic groups in Palestine. That said, he's young and he's dumb, and we've all been there.
Hmm. Now, just to be clear, Northeastern University, they wouldn't come on our show. They wouldn't talk to us. They did give us a statement and basically said this wasn't about the content of the leaflets. It wasn't about free speech. This was about following rules, about sort of time and place and permission. And Northeastern says all of these rules are imposed evenly across all student groups, and this particular group didn't abide by them. But Joan, what's your thought on what's going on here?
Well, my first thought was I was going to say I'm not going to try to match Harvey Silverglate's eloquence on free speech issues, and my second is ditto. I agree with everything that Jim said. And what you just said about Northeastern, I mean, I kind of find it hard to believe. I mean, I bet if some other leaflet was put under the door of students, you know, in a dormitory, they wouldn't have quite the same reaction. And I think it is about free speech. And a university is a place where different points of view should be debated, and you shouldn't be shutting that down and closing it off.
Well, we really urged Northeastern to come on our show yesterday. Harvey Silverglate sort of threw down the gauntlet and said, I will debate anyone from that university anytime over this issue.
They know better than to take him on.
Well, I think it's a terrific institution, and I'm sure they've got some smart people over there who could give Harvey a run for his money. We'd love to have that debate on our air, but anyway, we're not going to have it if they're not going to do it. But the door is open if they want to do it. Joan, I want to ask you really quickly about what you wrote this week about Senator Ed Markey. And so he's come under some fire for his scrutiny of the nutritional supplements company Herbalife. This is a company that's been accused of running sort of a Ponzi scheme. The issue here, not a Ponzi scheme, but exploiting the people that sell its products. And the issue here is that a Wall Street investor, William Ackman, stood to make a lot of money if the Herbalife stock fell. Ackman was in a position help me out here. Ackman gave money to Democrats that benefited Markey. Markey's staff members met with him, but not necessarily Markey. It's a complicated issue.
I'm so glad you just summed it up. I'm not going to try to add to it. And the question comes, Herbalife does seem to be a company that could bear scrutiny. And Senator Markey wrote letters to federal regulators saying, you know, requesting that they look into it. And they have now done so at his request. The issue is, did he know that this Wall Street guy, Ackman, stood to make $1 billion if Herbalife stock plunged down, which it would do if people started investigating
it. Right, and which it did as a result of his request that it be investigated.
Right, and it seems like it's on the way to an even more of a plummet now that the FTC is involved.
Yeah.
And he says no. His staff knew. He won't say who on his staff actually knew and who did all the looking into it, but that no one told him. And again, just I find that hard to believe that he didn't know. He says that he didn't know. I think he should have known. That way he could say, look, I had the full information in front of me, and I still think that on behalf of consumers and the residents of Massachusetts, this company should be investigated. But he is pleading ignorance.
Why do these stories always come down to this question? What did he know and when did he know?
I know. That's the perfect question for everything.
It really is. All right. Well, we've got time to move on to our hubbubs, those stories that slipped below the fold but which caught the eye of our panelists. Jim Sturgis, what's your hubbub this week?
Mine is 10,000 Chromebooks coming our way to the Boston Public Schools. These are low-cost machines, internet-based with all kinds of Google apps. It's fantastic in one way, and that is there's a huge digital divide between students in urban areas and, let's say, students who are in Metro West or other affluent communities. Their access to computers and to online learning. I put a limitation on that in the sense that this is not really about academics. There's no real connection between the number of computers you have and how well you do academically. So I would just close by urging Mayor Walsh to not lead from behind on the charter school issue, which is very much in debate right now, and to come out strongly in favor. We'd love to see that.
All right. All right. A plug there for charter schools from Jim Sturgis of the Pioneer Institute. Glad you got that.
What a surprise.
What a surprise. But not a problem. Joan, your hubbub today.
Well, I first heard this on the BBC NewsHour, I think, and then it was followed up on the obituary page of the New York Times, an obituary about a columnist from India, I hope I say his name correctly, Khushwant Singh, who died at age 99. When I heard the report, of course, it was about a newspaper columnist, so I was kind of interested. And then the title of his column, which was With Malice Towards One and All, which I thought was amusing. And it turned out that he's more than a columnist. I mean, he's a famous author, and he's had a very varied and interesting life. And basically kept on writing until pretty much the age of 99. And I just thought to have all of those opinions and to continue to have the passion to be able to formulate an argument and dish it out and then take what comes back at you when you tell the world what you think is pretty amazing. I looked up a few of the things that he said. I mean, he wrote about a vast variety of topics, but things like drinking. Drinking is not a vice. Drunkenness is. He seemed to have a lot of humility. When the prime minister's wife came to visit him, he said, now you go. And he wrote, because I felt a prime minister's wife had more important things to do than to waste time making polite conversation with an old man. And he just seemed like a wonderful character. So toast to him.
All right. Really nice. So my hubbub comes back to the more sort of prosaic world of politics. It comes from the fold, below the fold of the Coos County Democrat, Lancaster, New Hampshire. Former Senator Scott Brown was there last weekend on a listening tour as he considers a likely run for the U.S. Senate. And he stopped by the home of Herb Richardson, a Republican state representative, and they got talking about health care. And Brown called the Affordable Health Care Act a monstrosity. I think he assumed he was in safe territory there. But Richardson responded that the law had been a financial lifesaver for him and his wife. The Coos County Democrat writes, Richardson was injured on the job and was forced to live on his workers' comp for an extended period of time. It ultimately cost the couple their house. They were paying $1,100 a month for health insurance. Now, thanks to the subsidy for which they qualify, the Richardsons only pay $136 a month for health care, and his wife told Scott Brown, thank God for Obamacare. Now, obviously, as time moves on, there's lots of varying views on Obamacare, but maybe a slightly awkward moment there for Scott Brown. No word on what he had to say about that other than he moved on with his listening tour. So that news from the political hustings in New Hampshire. Jim Sturgis, Joan Vinaki, it's a first day of spring. Happy first day of spring to both of you.
Not feeling it.
I'm ready for it. Definitely ready for it.
All right, Joan Vinaki, Boston Globe columnist, Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute. Thank you both. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Good to be with you.
And stay with us. We'll hear from two of the three American hikers who were imprisoned in Iran for 2 years, accused of espionage. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.